The Word of Mouth Daily Podcast is brought to you by
Dartmouth Hitchcock,
creating a new model for healthcare
where leading health systems collaborate to improve care for all of us.
A sustainable system
improving the health of our communities
for years to come.
Information at imagine.d-h.org.
And
Doucette Survey,
serving your professional land surveying and mapping needs in New England,
now with offices in New Hampshire and Maine.
Information at doucetsurvey.com. That's doucetsurvey.com.
And
Northeast Credit Union, helping their members save money
through free checking accounts and refinancing of auto,
home, and personal loans.
Northeast Credit Union, encouraging you to discover the difference at necu.org.
Federally insured by NCUA.
Equal housing opportunity.
Word of mouth.
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 Mouth. Mouth.
This is Word of Mouth from New Hampshire Public Radio. I'm Taylor Quimby, in for Virginia Prescott. Often, the Western media portrays Sweden as a sort of modernist utopia, where blonde-haired trendmakers export up-tempo pop music, hip furniture, whilst the government offers up unparalleled maternity leave and a long history of generous immigration policies. I have myself at times joked to my wife, we should just move to Sweden, as though life itself would simply be easier there. But this is not how Sweden is depicted in Michael Booth's new book, The Almost Nearly Perfect People, Behind the Myth of the Scandinavian Utopia. Booth is British-born, but has lived in Denmark for many years now, and in his book he wryly describes Swedes as a stiff and conformist people, paralyzed by good manners, and their government as a sort of benign totalitarianism. Michael, welcome to the program.
Hi, how are you doing, Taylor?
I'm very well. So, Michael, as I started out by talking about how the Western world sees Sweden, can you tell me how Sweden is viewed by the rest of Scandinavia?
Well, that's the interesting thing, really. I mean, that's kind of why I started to write this book many years ago, was that when I moved to Denmark, I discovered there was this weird kind of dysfunctional family relationship up here with the Swedes. They're kind of like the older brother, the head boy, the goody-goody. They've generated quite a deal of resentment amongst their neighbors and envy over the last couple of hundred years, really. So it was that kind of weird relationship that got me started. I mean, basically the Swedes won. They won history. They won everything. They're rich, successful. They won the territory. They had these massive global brands. They had this amazingly well-functioning secular industrial society. And they have remained neutral for a couple of hundred years, supposedly, whilst selling arms to the rest of the world. There's a good deal of kind of accusations of hypocrisy from the Finns and Danes in particular. The Norwegians don't like them terribly much either.
Now, you did a lot of traveling through Scandinavia. You live in Denmark, but you visited all the other countries. And Sweden especially has a very interesting stereotype of a person who's, as I mentioned, stiff, very conformist. Did you find that that was the case in your experience?
Well, yeah, and it's not really me that's kind of decided this. If you ask the Swedes themselves, this is their self-image. It's quite interesting. When there are international surveys done for people to describe themselves in adjectives, the Swedes just use words like stiff, remote, humorless. They don't have a very great self-image compared to the Danes, who always describe themselves as the happiest people in the world. And the Swedes do tend to live up to some of their stereotypes. Greta Garbo famously wanted to be alone. She was a Swede. Mm-hmm. I always used to think that was just kind of some kind of shtick, but it's true. The Swedes do have isolationist tendencies. It is a huge country, a huge landmass, and they have traditionally lived kind of spread apart, not very densely populated. So they're used to getting by themselves. They also have what's called a very high context society, which means that they all are kind of homogenous. They think the same, they eat the same food, drive the same cars, wear the same clothes, see the same films. They think in the same kind of way. In the book, I have a rather kind of flippant chapter where I go to Stockholm and spend a day trying to behave as un-Swedishly as possible.
Yeah, one of my favorite stories from that chapter is where you visited the Nobel Museum and yeah, sort of tested their manners.
I ate a pack of potato chips and slurped my Coke underneath a sign saying no eating or drinking. And I also tried to cross the road on red, which is just not done generally in Scandinavia, and would sidle up to people on benches and try and start a conversation or get into a lift with Swedes and see them leave rather than share a lift with me. They're just not very social people. And again, this isn't really me going there and saying, pointing the finger. It's the Swedes themselves. I interviewed their greatest ethnologist, Åke Dorn, who's like the expert on Swedish mentality. He literally wrote the book on it. And he told me he did a similar experiment once where He's been living in the same lovely part of Stockholm for decades and would see the same people on the streets every day, and they'd ignore each other studiously. And so he decided to say hello out of the blue. And he was overwhelmed with the positive response. It was such a revolutionary thing for a Swede to do.
Now, do you think the qualities that the Swedes used to describe themselves, you know, polite, conformist, later you talk about lacking in chivalry, do you think these are necessary trade-offs required to live in such a successful welfare state like they do?
No, not really, because there are other successful welfare states in Europe that do without that kind of, you know, I'm English, right? So I'm used to these rather baroque, extreme forms of manners, which I agree are kind of, you know, weird. But if I go into a store in Britain, and I've done this, and I've counted how many times in a transaction to buy a newspaper, how many times you say the word please and thank you. It's like 12 or 13 times. It's all, excuse me, please, thank you. Well, so we have a good welfare state, and we're chatty, right? The Swedes have a fantastic welfare state. They're not chatty. I don't think it has anything to do with it.
Well, so you don't think that there's any connection maybe between the sort of isolated sensibility that they hold and the way that the dependent on the state rather than each other?
No, I think more it's a case of high trust societies tend to create a kind of social network, a social kind of foundation in which welfare states flourish very well. Because if you trust each other, if you trust your government and authorities to administer your taxes fairly and to redistribute the wealth fairly, then those welfare states tend to function much better. And that you can see across the Nordic countries, they have high levels of social trust, high levels of social cohesion. The Swedes and the Danes belong to more clubs, associations. They do more voluntary work than almost anyone else in the world. And that certainly helps to knit the fabric of society very closely together.
How does this all connect to the very different history? They're descendants of Vikings, and yet they're now, you know, the most polite peoples we can sort of imagine. How does that all connect?
Well, actually, they're not polite at all. In fact, in my book, I talk about the Swedes as being in the public sphere, the most rude people I've ever met, encountered outside of Hong Kong Chinese. They're incredibly brusque and bad-mannered. You know, if they don't know you on the buses, on the trains, out in public, they use their elbows without apologizing. They don't hold door. You know, they're really, really shockingly rude from an English perspective. And I'm not the only Englishman who's noticed this. So, and that, maybe that's the Viking gene coming out there. I think the whole Viking thing is rather overstated, actually. This was something that happened 1,000 years ago. But, you know, we were learning more and more about the Vikings, about what a complex, actually very civilized people they were.
Right.
But I'm not sure they were more brutal than anyone else.
I'm speaking with Michael Booth. He's author of The Almost Nearly Perfect People, Behind the Myth of the Scandinavian Utopia. I want to get back to a phrase that I mentioned when I introduced you that really caught me reading the book, benign totalitarianism. You weren't the first to use the term, but it really struck me. What is the argument there that Sweden is in some ways a totalitarianism society?
Well, we're familiar with the concept of a totalitarian state as one with a one-party ruler that dictates, you know, how the country is run.
Right.
Now, Sweden's social democrats pretty much did rule the country for the vast majority of the last 50 to 80 years. So, and yes, there was democracy. Yes, there were elections. But as is often happens when one party has a lot of power, they took over the judiciary, they took over the media, they took over academia. So social democracy became the national creed, if you like. And so the benign part of it is, you know, they weren't queuing for potatoes like the Russians were. Everyone had a nice car. Everyone had an extremely high standard of living. So again, the wealth was distributed extremely effectively, and they had this fantastic cradle-to-grave welfare state and safety net. So that was the benign aspect of it. I have met Swedes who have complained that they don't feel particularly free when they're in Sweden, and have they indeed left Sweden, because certain freedoms are not officially curtailed, but if, for example, you want to be a mother who stays at home to raise her kids, that's not particularly approved of, and the social systems don't particularly support that. So yeah, you're free, but you're free to be Swedish.
To keep the analogy going a little bit, you know, censorship, I suppose, would be a big part of a totalitarian state. And there has been this sort of agreement not to give a far-right party, the Sweden Democrat Party, very much airtime during the last election. Now, what's the story there, and does it make sense? Does it not make sense?
I can see both sides of this one. You know, the Sweden Democrats are a pretty odious bunch. They have their roots in the neo-Nazi movement in Sweden. They're bigoted, anti-immigration, particularly anti-Muslim. Mm-hmm. I've interviewed them. They're not particularly appealing, and they have kind of stupid and ridiculous views. Now, to put it bluntly, now in Sweden, none of the political parties will work with them. They've been shunned in parliament since they came in the election before last, actually. And the media has kind of self-censored them. So they, and some newspapers wouldn't accept their adverts. They were excluded from debate programs on TV on kind of spurious grounds. Now, this has kind of backfired because they scored 13% in the last election and have a bigger presence in parliament than ever. And there is a sense that that view, that whole dialogue about immigration has become a taboo, and it's rather exploded in the Swedes' faces. This is certainly the view from Denmark, where their own right-wing party has been much more a part of the mainstream for the last 15 years. Indeed, for a lot of the last 15 years, it was the kind of the kingmaker in the government.
And this is the whole, I mean, this is the difference in terms of how we all view freedom of speech. You know, I mean, we know right now we've talked a lot about Charlie Hebdo. The Danish cartoons came up after that. And it seems like there is a very different idea of what freedom of speech should be in Sweden versus in Denmark and versus, I suppose, in the UK and the United States.
Absolutely. And that was really epitomized just a couple of months ago, actually, by a Swedish artist called Park, who, based in Malmö, I believe, created some pretty offensive works of art with showing black people being lynched and really unpleasant art, actually, if you could call it art. His works were confiscated in Sweden, and he came, I think, to live in Copenhagen or spend a lot of time in Copenhagen. And here, people tried to put on a show of his work. And even a state-sponsored radio station promoted him and kind of championed his cause. So the Danes have a very different view. They have a kind of anything-goes view in terms of free speech, unless it comes to criticizing their queen, of course. You're not allowed to do that.
So do you have any ideas after writing this book about why the Western media does tend to see Sweden and, in fact, the rest of Scandinavia through such rose-tinted glasses when there is racism, xenophobia, you know, things under the surface, under the main narrative that we would find anywhere else? Why do we see it so perfectly?
Well, first of all, I think they fulfill a need that we all have for a utopia, right? A utopia on Earth. And since the economic crash and the euro crash, we used to dream of a house in Provence or Tuscany or wherever. I think we kind of shifted our eyes north because they offered us a different set of values, a different kind of way, a formula for running society that seemed less capitalistic, less grasping, more functional, more simple, that kind of back to basics thing. And then there's what I call the White Album argument, right? Paul McCartney was once asked by a journalist, he said, shouldn't the White Album have been maybe just a one disc album instead of a double album? Because there were some, you know, filler songs on there that weren't that good. And McCartney said, well, yeah, but it's still the White Album. And, you know, when you say that there's racism and there's xenophobia up here in the North, there is, but not that much compared to other countries in Europe. And things still function extremely well here. I live here of my own free will. It's a great place to live. It's safe. Things work, it's fair, it's equal, and I don't really see anywhere else that's doing it any better.
So as close to perfect as we'll find.
As I say, the book's called The Almost Nearly Perfect, people, and I do, you know, sometimes I'm very critical because the media asks me to be critical, but that is genuinely how I feel about these countries.
Well, Michael Booth, thank you so much for speaking with me today.
You're welcome, Taylor. Nice to meet you.
Nice to meet you. Michael Booth is the author of The Almost Nearly Perfect People, Behind the Myth of the Scandinavian Utopia. And you can find more about the book at our website, wordofmouthradio.org. Well, you can't bring up Swedish culture without bringing up its contributions to the world of pop music. While ABBA's catalog may be the first songs that come to mind when you think of Swedish pop, the Swedes have been involved in way more hits than you might realize. Take Taylor Swift's most recent album, 1989. 9 of the 13 tracks on that record were co-written by Swedish producer Max Martin. But that's not the only pop song Max Martin and his gang of Swedish artists have helped produce. Here's just a sampling of the many, many, many hits they've brought to the U.S. over the years. So Sweden may not be a perfect utopia, but they do know how to turn out a good dance beat. We'll stay in Scandinavia for a bit longer to uncover a growing trend among the DIY set, IKEA hacking. Instead of following the assembly directions, some people are opting to use IKEA's raw materials to create their own customized furniture. And we'll hear more from that story when Word of Mouth continues. This is Word of Mouth from NHPR. I'm Taylor Quimby, in for Virginia Prescott. If you've ever purchased a set of shelves from IKEA, you know the drill. Follow the detailed instructions, and a few hours, and possibly tantrums later, you'll wind up with a set of reasonably priced, sturdy shelves. But what happens when you don't follow the script? In this next story, 99% Invisible's Roman Mars explores the world of IKEA hacking.
IKEA hacking
is what we've been doing.
And this is friend of the show, Sean Cole. And yes, he said IKEA hacking.
I feel good about it. It feels a little bit subversive and a little bit bourgeois.
You've probably heard of IKEA hacking. It's the practice of buying stuff from IKEA and then re-engineering it, hacking it, into customized, more functional, and often just way better designed stuff. In Sean's case, that stuff is 3 5-foot-high shelves.
Shelves from IKEA. We've laid them down on their sides.
He is drilling and screwing and bolting together one big, beautiful, queen-sized storage bed.
Wrench and bolts.
Wrench and bolts.
This is Sean's partner in crime, IKEA hacker Jonathan Bean.
4 bolts and 1 wrench.
He's an assistant professor at Bucknell University. Back in 2009, he co-wrote a serious academic paper about IKEA hacking with Daniela Rossner, who now teaches design at the University of Washington. And they got interested in part because of how bendable the term IKEA hacking is.
It could be anything from, I bought this shelf at IKEA and it was an inch too long for my closet, so I cut an inch off of it.
Or it could be where you just take, say, a salad bowl and make it into a light.
And this is Daniela.
Right, that's not even actually changing the object itself, that's just changing its use.
And the hackerati aren't just diverse in terms of their sensibility, they're diverse in the most basic way possible.
The locus of the IKEA hacking movement is a website called IKEAHackers.net.
You see hacks posted from all over this country and from Australia, Russia, Israel, Dubai. Someone posted a hack that's a French country house library in an actual French country house. He has these before and after pictures and explained all how he did it. And make no mistake, the actual posts themselves, the showing your work, that's a huge part of this whole thing. Because this is the thing. IKEA, in spite of itself, is the great leveler.
Because everything's exactly the same at IKEA, no matter where you are, it sort of lowers the barriers to recreating something. If you go and buy a stud, a wood stud at a Home Depot in the US, it's gonna be 1.5 by 3.5 inches. If you go and buy a wood stud at Bauhaus, which is a German home improvement store, it's going to be a different size.
I mean, clearly IKEA exists, right, in these various parts of the world. So if I posted an IKEA hack in Boston and someone in the Netherlands saw it, they could probably reproduce it using this, you know, the pieces at their local store, much like a Lego kit.
And it's that very homogeneity, that McDonald's-like sameness from place to place to place, that's what's allowing this global community of hackers to thrive.
Okay, this is the best part, actually. We're about to drill unsanctioned holes into a piece of IKEA furniture.
You're not going to be able to take it back.
That's fine.
You want to have at it?
Actually, yeah. May I do the honors?
Sure.
So why is this your favorite part?
I mean, I think that it's just that for the longest time, you know, you're told that drilling holes where they're not supposed to go is destructive and wrong. And we were doing that, and it's still transgressive, and you're crossing a boundary, but it's not destruction anymore. It's creation. It felt like for once I wasn't just saying, what's out there? You know, which one on the menu do I want? We were making what we wanted.
Yeah, but you were still shopping at IKEA.
true.
All right, this is the final touch. We're going to put the mattress onto my new IKEA bed. It fits! Oh boy, it's a bed! It's a bed! It's a real bed!
It's so comfortable.
That story came to us from 99% Invisible and producers Sean Cole and Roman Mars. And Word of Mouth continues with the latest installment of our series, Good Gig. We'll hear from Ryan Knapp, a meteorologist based on the very cold and inhospitable summit of Mount Washington, and he'll explain why he has the adventurer's dream job. That's after the news.
Word of Mouth.
Word of Mouth.
Word of Mouth.
Word of Mouth.
This is Word of Mouth from New Hampshire Public Radio. I'm Taylor Quimby, in for Virginia Prescott. If you listen to NHPR on the weekends, you've likely heard this voice reporting New Hampshire's weather in meticulous detail.
As the low exits, a ridge of high pressure will build down from the north, allowing for fair skies to linger overnight into Sunday.
Unlike most forecasters, though, meteorologist Ryan Knapp isn't standing in front of a green screen or talking into a microphone from our comfy studio in Concord. He's actually reporting directly from one of the most hostile environments in the country, the top of Mount Washington. Ryan Knapp is also the unlikely guest today for our series Good Gig. And Ryan, welcome to the program.
Well, thank you for having me.
So you are the night meteorologist at the Mount Washington Observatory. So can you just describe your surroundings right now? What does it look like?
Right now we're in the fog. Visibility is kind of limited to 1/16 of a mile, which is actually improved from this morning when it was only down to 50 feet. We have light snow falling, and the winds actually have diminished to about 15 miles per hour. So the snow is actually falling vertically, which is kind of rare up here.
You're safely inside, we should clarify.
Yeah, at the moment, I'm safely inside in a little tiny recording room. So nothing outside right now.
And is that where you usually do most of your work? I mean, what's the observatory look like for folks who have never made the trek either by car or by foot to the peak?
The observatory is a two-level structure. The top level is a weather observatory office. It has most of our instrumentation, a little tiny recording room, and then a conference room for when we get together on Wednesdays. Then downstairs, we have our living quarters, which have bunk rooms that are similar to what you would see in like a college dorm experience. We then have a kitchen, dining area, and then a living room where we can get together and watch movies or play board games or anything like that. So it's a real cozy, small structure. Then above us, we have a weather tower where we have most of our instrumentation that is measuring the winds and temperature and pressure and so on.
Now, Mount Washington, it's 6,200?
Yep, 6,288 feet.
Okay. And I mean, we all know it's branded as home of the world's worst weather. Is it really that bad? I mean, I know that I've seen some pretty wild pictures, but on an average day, what are you dealing with?
On an average day up here, especially in the winter months, which we actually count from October to May, every other day we see a hurricane force wind. So that means winds in excess of 73 miles per hour.
Wow.
Then one out of every 4 days, we usually see gusts over 100 miles per hour. So wind alone is one factor. But then when you factor in temperatures that we see up here, it can be very cold. We get blowing snow. We get falling snow. Visibility, like I said, this morning was really severely limited. And if you get all those factors coming together, it can be a really hostile and a very dangerous environment if you don't know what you're doing or if you don't look at a forecast ahead of time.
So a lot of folks in New Hampshire have probably driven up to the peak of Mount Washington via the auto road. It's a really beautiful road. I definitely recommend it if you've never been. What's that like in the wintertime? You said October through, I forget when, that's considered winter at Mount Washington. So how do you get up to the top?
During the early part of the season and towards the end of the season, we take a truck or van with chains 4x4 up the road. But as conditions get deeper and deeper, usually by the end of November, we start taking what's called a snowcat or a snow tractor. What you would typically see those at is a ski resort, except for ours has a modified back end, which has a small cabin on it. So it allows us to ride up in the back of the snow tractor. So huge tracks, the thing takes up pretty much the entire road and just kind of makes its way up the summit. There are days, though, when it has to plow through snow that's several feet deep. In one section of the road, it gets to about 10 feet deep in the middle of winter. So a lot of work to get up here sometimes.
How long does it take?
On a good day, which would be very clear and not a lot of, you know, blade work, it would take about an hour 15 to get up here. On a really bad day, I've seen it take upwards of 6 hours just one direction up.
Wow.
So it just varies depending on how the conditions are on the road.
And that's an 8 mile trip, 6 hours.
Yep, the top speed is about 8 miles per hour. So it's not a very fast moving tractor, but if you start getting visibility limited, it goes even slower.
So people are probably asking themselves now, like, why we're having you on for our series Good Gig, which is supposed to be about people with great, unusual jobs. What makes your job so fantastic, given that you are at the mercy of the weather?
It has its good days and it has its bad days. And what's great is in meteorology, the spectrum goes from, you know, the stereotypical TV meteorologist, and then you have National Weather Service on the other end of the spectrum, and then there's kind of everything in between. What's great about this job is it kind of allows me to do a wide spectrum of things in meteorology. So you have the forecasting aspect that then, you know, I get to go outside and actually feel the weather that I'm forecasting for. So when I'm saying a 100 mile per hour gust, I'm going out and actually feeling what those feel like. And, you know, we get visibility where we have sunsets that are 130-mile visibility with colorful skies. And then
wow.
Other days you have blowing snow and everything else up here. So no 2 days are exactly alike. It's just a very unique environment and a lot of fun to see all the various weather elements that you learn in textbooks actually coming to life up here.
And how long have you been there?
I've been here since December of 2005, so I think 9 years now.
And have in that time, I mean, I'm imagining you've seen some really amazing, some amazing phenomenon. The Aurora Borealis, you know, stars that I can't even imagine seeing from where I live in Concord. Is that sort of thing a daily occurrence?
It's not too daily. We're in the fog up here about 60% of the year, so it can be very rare just to see a starry sky at night. The Aurora Borealis is even more rare. I think in the amount of time that I've been here, I've only seen it about a dozen times. So It's not a very common occurrence, but when it does occur, it's definitely very unique and nothing I've ever seen prior to working at this location.
I'm speaking with Ryan Knapp. He's night meteorologist at the Mount Washington Observatory, and you've probably heard him here on the weekends at New Hampshire Public Radio. He's our guest today for our series Good Gig. Tell me a little bit about your daily routine. I know if you're the night meteorologist, I'm guessing that means you work through the night. Is it like third shift?
Actually, we have two shifts. So we work 5:30 to 5:30. So my shift starts at 5:30 p.m. and ends at 5:30 a.m. I have a little bit of overlap when I first wake up with the day observers. I usually get up around 2, 3 in the afternoon, and then we work together and kind of get an idea of what was going on during the day versus the night. And then everybody kind of kicks off to bed about 10 o'clock, and then I'm on my own from 10 o'clock until they wake up at around 5. If the weather is severe, though, we will usually wake somebody up or have somebody up with me just to be in the building waiting for me to get back in to be safe and sound rather than wondering where I am at 6 a.m. in the morning.
To get back in, so you actually go outside every night for your shift?
Yeah, once an hour we go outside to take our weather readings and measurements. So we're out there physically in it, taking temperature readings, de-icing the instrumentation, because no matter what any product says, we have yet to find a product that will remain completely ice-free. So we still have to go out and de-ice, and then we have to collect a precipitation can, which is in the middle of the summit. So we're physically going out there at least once an hour, if not more, to make sure all the instrumentation is working and also getting our readings. So we're physically out there throughout the day and the night.
Now, what's that? I mean, you said every 4 days you're hitting 100-mile-an-hour gusts. What is that like when you are outside on a weekly basis in, you know, a hurricane-force wind?
I could say that you get used to it, but you never really get used to it. And even days where we see the 100-mile-per-hour gusts, no 2 days are exactly alike with those either. A lot of people that come up here actually don't know what winds feel like at that speed. In the summertime, we have tourists that come up here via the auto road or the cog or hiking or whatever. And while we're outside taking our observations, we'll overhear them saying, oh, man, it's got to be blowing at least 30 up here. And you go back in and it's only blowing about 10 miles per hour. And it's just because people aren't used to feeling those kind of winds on them that they don't really know how to calibrate themselves to what the actual speed is up here.
And Ryan, I'm wondering, what is the living situation like? You mentioned that there's bunks, there's a kitchen, there's a pantry. You're working 12-hour shifts, and I'm guessing that you are often stuck in the mountain. You probably can't get down, especially during the winter times when the road is just too hairy.
Yep. So on any given week, we're up here from Wednesday to Wednesday. So we stay 8 days on up here, living, working, and et cetera. And then we get 6 days off in the valley. However, if the wind is bad or the temperatures or whatever conditions force us to stay up here, we can stay one or two extra days. It just depends on what's going on. While we're up here, though, we have three observers that are typically on our shift. And then we have one intern and then one or two volunteers that are up here for the week. So we have kind of a mountain family, as we call it, up here. So we get together and have dinner and play board games and kind of have a communal effort at the end of the day. So you don't really get that cabin fever that everybody assumes that you have up here, because you definitely have an out to talk to other people. And the people that we work with up here are just really great people, and kind of we screen really well before we work with them to make sure we get personalities that we know we can get along with.
I think that makes a lot of sense, given the conditions. Oh, yeah. So that makes me wonder, this is probably not the type of job that everybody would love. I mean, there's a lot of folks who like the comfort of a warm home and like to be able to drive to the store and do those sorts of things. So who do you think this job is perfect for, and who is it absolutely the worst for?
Definitely the worst for people, like you were saying, that enjoy those creature comforts or having a normal schedule. It's definitely tough on people that have families going, because you're basically missing out on your kids growing up every other week. So a lot of us are single. However, we have had, you know, people that have had kids in the past, but you typically have to have a mindset of kind of being slightly crazy, I guess, you know, to put your body in that kind of extreme weather every other week. But at the same time, a sense of adventure, a longing for fun, and just wanting to experience, you know, the physical aspect of weather and not just looking at pretty pictures on a screen.
Well, Ryan Knapp, you're a brave man. Thank you so much for speaking with me today.
Thank you for having me.
Ryan Knapp is night meteorologist at the Mount Washington Observatory. You can see some beautiful pictures from the peak. And, of course, you can hear his voice on many weekends here on New Hampshire Public Radio giving the forecast. And you can check out all that at wordofmouthradio.org. If you think you have an unusually great gig, or you know somebody who does, we want to hear about it. So shoot us an email at wordofmouth@nhpr.org and put good gig in the subject line. And the cold winds continue to blow on Word of Mouth. Up next, a look into China's push to build a frozen food infrastructure and what that means for global climate change. First, a quick break.
Word of Mouth!
This is Word of Mouth from New Hampshire Public Radio. I'm Taylor Quimby in for Virginia Prescott. It's hard to imagine life before the introduction of the mechanical refrigerator, when food was imminently perishable and ice was harvested from ponds and lakes and delivered door to door. Ironically, our modern love of keeping food cold is directly contributing to the overall warming of our planet. Artificial cooling is responsible for a whopping 15% of the world's energy consumption, led, of course, by the United States. But China, who came late to the refrigeration game, is set to overtake American cold storage consumption in the next decade. And that's just the beginning. Nicola Twilley is a writer currently working on a book about refrigeration. And this summer she wrote an article for New York Times Magazine, What Do Chinese Dumplings Have to Do with Global Warming? She joined Virginia to answer that very riddle.
The luxury of owning a refrigerator and a freezer in the home is a relatively new one in China. Now, when did this cold storage boom, as you call it, first begin?
Well, at the start of the 90s, fewer than 1 in 10 Chinese people had a refrigerator in their home. Today, it's 95% of urban families. So that got started in the 90s and is really complete now. The other part of the refrigeration boom is the part you don't tend to see in your day-to-day life, which is refrigerated warehouses and refrigerated trucks and all of the sort of behind-the-scenes, what the industry experts call the cold chain, which is a seamless network of refrigeration from farm to your refrigerator.
And that is what part of what your article details. But first, you write that now 95% of urban households in China do own a refrigerator. With such a small percentage of the population left, which I still know is significant in China, how much further does the cold storage boom have to go before it tops out?
Oh, it has a long way to go. First of all, those numbers are for urban Chinese. The situation in the countryside is very different. There is still fewer, it's a minority of people that have a refrigerator. So there's still a lot of growth, even just in the domestic refrigerator market. In terms of actual cold storage at the national level, if you think every single American has 13 cubic foot of refrigerated space per capita, that it's somewhere out there with your name on it. And a Chinese person, even after a decade's worth of this cold storage boom, has just under 4 cubic feet, so less than a third of what we have in the U.S., really. So there's a long way to grow.
Well, let's get back to this idea that introducing frozen food does not just, you know, happen at the point of getting from a store to a home refrigerator. It is an elaborate infrastructure getting a meal from a manufacturer to the dinner plate. This is what you referred to earlier as the cold chain. Can you just describe some of the stages in that chain?
Well, take a frozen dumpling, for example, which is the most popular frozen food in China. In the U.S., frozen pizza is by far and away the most popular frozen food, but Chinese people don't like cheese as a general rule, so it's the dumpling that has sort of been the gateway frozen food there. And that has to be made in the cold. It has to be flash frozen in a factory, has to be stored in that factory, kept freezing. When it's ready to go out, you need trucks that can keep it at freezing. They're going to distribute it to a warehouse, probably on the edge of a city somewhere, perhaps belonging to a Walmart, perhaps belonging to a different distributor or a wholesaler. And then from there, smaller trucks tend to take it into the city, either to a grocery store or, as is increasingly happening in China, direct to the consumers as people get... they're sort of leapfrogging the supermarket stage and going straight into e-grocery shopping.
So a lot to be done, a lot of money to be made, and this has become a very important government-aided initiative. So what are some of the social benefits or health benefits to refrigeration?
Well, I think the main things are food safety. I mean, obviously, as we see in the headlines every day, food safety is a pressing issue in China, and refrigeration is and a seamless cold chain is one way to really cut down on that. There was a study done by a consulting firm that showed that Chinese consumers expect to have an upset stomach from bad food twice a week. That's totally normal for them. That's the average.
Wow.
And a lot of that is just from the fact that, I mean, currently in China, less than a quarter of meat is transported under refrigeration. The number for vegetables is 5%. So you can imagine that a lot of bad things are happening as that food travels from where it's grown to where it's going to be eaten. And refrigeration could help prevent a lot of that.
And also prevent waste.
That's the other big thing. At the moment, China throws away 40%, I mean nearly half actually, of what it grows. And it throws it away in that journey between the producer and then the retailer. So before a consumer ever gets to even see this, half of what China grows has been thrown away. And it's simply because it rots en route. You can't keep it fresh, especially in the summer. I went to the wholesale market that supplies 80% of Beijing's vegetables, and the farmers had packed individual heads of broccoli in ice and hay to try and keep it cold and insulated.
Uh-huh.
And they just dig out one head at a time and sell it to people. But you can't, the farmer told me he expects to lose a quarter of the truck in summer.
To create a flawless cold chain would take significant energy. Where is China sourcing most of its energy from now? Is it still coal?
Yes, it is still coal, unfortunately. So it's the dirtiest kind of energy. And it's not just electricity that is the problem, actually, with refrigeration. There's this the issue of what chemicals you use inside your refrigeration system. They're called refrigerants. And I think a lot of us thought we dealt with the refrigerant problem when we got rid of CFCs and we stopped, you know, forming the hole in the ozone layer in the 80s. But unfortunately, their replacements, HFCs, turn out to be sort of 1,000 times, if not more, some of them are even more warming than that, but 1,000 times more warming than carbon dioxide as greenhouse gases.
And these HFCs are discharged or formed because of refrigeration.
Yeah, we make these chemicals because they are the chemicals that sort of run around inside the refrigeration system, you know, in those coils. They're the ones performing the heat exchange. They leak different amounts from different systems. Supermarkets can leak as much as, you know, 15-20% a year. And because they're chosen for use as refrigerants because they're so stable, but because they're so stable, they sit in the atmosphere forever. And they're, like I say, they have 1,000 times more, they call it global warming potential. So for every ton of those, it's 1,000 times more warming than a ton of CO2.
Nicola Twilley is with us. She's writing a book on refrigeration and recently wrote about China's cold storage boom for the New York Times Magazine. As this cold chain expands, China is also experiencing huge leaps forward, if I can use those terms, huge leaps forward in energy efficiency and the growth of renewable resources. Now, might some of those efforts help mitigate some of the energy needs that cold storage requires?
Oh, absolutely. You can both make a refrigeration system more efficient and you can power it with clean energy. Definitely. And those don't affect the refrigerant problem, but they do affect the electricity problem, which is 80% of the environmental impact of a cold storage warehouse comes from the electricity use. So you can absolutely do that. The question is, can you do it at the scale? I mean, the thing that is easy to sometimes forget about China is that there are 1.4 billion people there. And if they all have even half as much refrigeration as we do in the U.S., that's an awful lot of clean energy to find and doesn't exist right now.
It's so interesting because I remember, you know, 10 years ago, I guess, conversations about global warming or energy conservation all somehow got to, well, everybody in India and China is now going to want cars. And now the conversation is about refrigeration, something far less obvious.
It's sort of, I mean, and that's why I'm so obsessed with refrigeration. I feel as though we completely overlook it. It's sort of this invisible network that we completely rely on. It's the only thing that keeps our food system in the U.S. running. It's the only way you feed our cities is through refrigeration. And yet most people couldn't take you to the nearest refrigerated warehouse or even point out a refrigerated truck on the highway.
Mm. Well, it's certainly changed the way Americans eat. How has refrigeration changed the way people in China eat?
Well, it's very interesting at the moment because, and this is one of the reasons I was so excited to travel to China for the Times, because they're refrigerating in fast forward. They're cooling down the entire food system, but it's so quickly that you see generational shifts in action. So the old folk, I had an old lady teach me how to make dumplings from scratch, and I asked her whether she would rather have a bike or a refrigerator if she could only have one, and she just looked at me like I was stupid. Like obviously she would keep the bike. I mean, how else would she get around? You don't need a refrigerator. Whereas my 26-year-old interpreter that I traveled around with had no bike, depended on his refrigerator, and lived on frozen dumplings. It's really, you know, the older generation are still shopping in wet markets. They're still shopping every day and cooking it fresh that evening. They're still making these things by hand, preserving things traditionally. If you walk around Beijing, people will be air-drying sausages outside their window, for example, things like that. And the younger generation, absolutely not. Don't know how to cook, don't want to know. Very much convenience-focused, as we are in the U.S.
That was Virginia Prescott speaking with Nicola Twilley about her article for the New York Times Magazine, What Do Chinese Dumplings Have to Do with Global Warming? Thank you so much for joining us today. If you like what you heard, there's more at wordofmouthradio.org. You can also follow us, send us your feedback, or share your ideas for the program on Facebook and on Twitter. After all, the most fascinating stories do tend to travel by word of mouth. I'm Taylor Quimby, in for Virginia Prescott. You can join us for more Word of Mouth tomorrow at 2 on New Hampshire Public Radio.